Welcome to Chiropractic Science, where you get to hear interviews with leading chiropractic researchers from around the world. My name is Dr. Dean Smith, and I am the host of Chiropractic Science. I am a clinical professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Health at Miami University, and I'm also a chiropractor in Eaton, Ohio. My research interests relate to understanding how chiropractic affects motor control and human performance. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Ronald Farabaugh. But before we get to the interview, I wanted to thank all of you who have subscribed to Chiropractic Science, and I'm also especially appreciative to all of you who have contributed five-star reviews on iTunes. We're on all of the other major podcasting apps like Spotify, etc. So if you leave a review on any of those apps, it really helps others find out about chiropractic and chiropractic science. So if you like the show, please take a second and write a review. It will support chiropractors everywhere. Please consider making a contribution to Chiropractic Science to keep these podcasts going. You can do so on our website by making a donation. All right, on to the podcast. Well, let's get on to the interview with Dr. Ronald Farabaugh. Dr. Farabaugh has been in practice in Ohio since 1982. He was appointed by the governor in 1994 to serve on the Healthcare Quality Advisory Council to help design managed care programs for the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, specifically qualified healthcare plans. He became the 1996 president of the Ohio Chiropractic Association, that's the OSCA. He is the former chairman of the CCGPP, the Council on Chiropractic Guidelines and Practice Parameters. He was past president of the Ohio Chiropractic State Board, appointed by Governor Strickland in 2010. He's on the ODG Board of Advisors, that's the Official Disability Guidelines. He currently serves as VP and National Physical Medicine Director for Advanced Medicine Integration Group, AMI. Dr. Farabaugh was appointed to serve on the Scientific Commission of the Clinical Compass, and he has published 15 papers on clinical practice guidelines in peer-reviewed journals, including the paper that we're going to get to discuss today on cost-effectiveness that just came out in March of 2024. Dr. Farabaugh, thanks so much for coming on the Chiropractic Science Podcast.
No problem, Dean. Thank you so much for having me. It's exciting times in chiropractic right now, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And this paper is really exciting. I must say, just the title gets me excited. So, I tell you what, I'd love to hear more about your story. And I think chiropractors around the world would really like to hear how you got into, you know, ultimately publishing this paper, but just your journey. I think it's always interesting to hear how people got into chiropractic and how you got to the stage. So why don't you just tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, it's been an interesting ride for me. I mean, I was growing up, my family was always medical. And when I went to University of Pittsburgh to do my undergraduate, you know, my life's dream was to become a surgeon. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. And that kind of got derailed because my second year at University of Pittsburgh, my father had a stroke. And it was a mild stroke that he recovered from. But when I went home to visit him in the hospital, I found out that they had taken him off all his medication. And I started quizzing the doc. I'm like, I don't understand. This medication has supposedly been keeping him alive for 15 years, and it was Aldomet, Ismolin, Enderon, and Inderol. I'll never forget them. And they took him off all these drugs, and he said, well, they him hot around a while, and eventually admitted that the drugs they think caused his stroke. It literally took his blood pressure down too far, and that's why it was a minor stroke that he thankfully recovered from. But that just didn't make sense to me. So I went back to Pitt, and I went to their pharmacy library. And here I am as an undergraduate student, didn't know you weren't allowed in the pharmacy library unless you're a pharmacy student, but there I was. And I'm looking up all these drugs. I got all these books in front of me, and these two guys sat down. They were pharmacy students. And then a professor of pharmacology sat down. And then I think the dean of pharmacy actually joined us for a few minutes. And the one question they could never answer for me was, I mean, each drug just relieved a different symptom of his blood pressure. One worked on his brain, one worked on his heart, one worked on his kidneys. And none of it really got to the cause of his blood pressure. Now, let me keep in mind, in this era of healthcare, this was in 1979, somewhere around there. Lifestyle choices, diet, nutrition, exercise, those weren't big issues of concern back then. In fact, the advice they gave my father for his blood pressure was quit drinking and drink diet Mountain Dews instead. And can you imagine that advice today?
Wow.
But the question they could ever answer for me was, does anybody know what's going to happen to a person's body when you randomly just throw all these drugs together? And, they avoided that question for 2 hours. And after a while, they finally said, no, because I was persistent. They said, no, not only can we not tell, we don't even test for it. And that's typical what happens in medicine. And I'm not here to knock medicine. Medicine has done a lot of great things. But the fact matter is, it's very siloed. It's symptom drug, symptom drug, symptom drug, symptom drug. And that's why so many people today, especially adults and the elderly, are on massive amounts of medication. I mean, one of my own family members is on 16, 17, 18 medications right now. It's just ridiculous. And so anyway, I knew I wanted to stay in the medical field, but medicine just really wasn't making sense to me. It just was not logical. So I went and visited an osteopath, a dentist, a podiatrist, a chiropractor. And what I saw in the chiropractic office was this chiropractor taking down people's blood pressure with an adjustment right then and there in the office while I was watching it. And I went, okay, how does that work? And again, I'm not here to suggest that everybody in the world that has high blood pressure can be cured by a chiropractor, but I'll tell you, it can certainly help. And there's some decent research out there on that topic. But the point is, I found a home in chiropractic. It made sense to me. So I just loved the logic of it. I loved the understanding of the nervous system and the spine and how intricately related it is. And so I went home and, one of the places that I went in my journey was a local chiropractor, and myself and his son became chiropractors and have been friends for 40 years, right? He got me into chiropractic. And the fact of the matter is, it's been a great ride. I've loved every minute of this journey. So I started practice in 1982 after I graduated Palmer in Davenport. And my first job was an associate with a chiropractor with a very large practice out in Pataskala, Ohio. And then after 2 years of internship there, associateship, I went in on my own. And I've been here ever since in Columbus, Ohio, since 1982. So
that's amazing. It's been fun. Yeah, that's so cool to hear about that pathway and just I can sort of imagine your wheels turning in your head, like, what is this all about? And then, really diving into, the research at the time. And yeah, right. It's interesting, the whole thing about lifestyle. I mean, that's just a testament to how much things change over time, isn't it? And I imagine when you were first in practice, the idea of cost that we're going to talk about today, there were probably no articles, if any, I don't know, about cost. I don't think the research had grown that much at all at that point. But we can talk about that as we go on. I'm curious, though, Dr. Faribault, what about the becoming president of the OSCA and then the board? I think that would be interesting for listeners, too, to just hear about those experiences.
Well, that's a great topic because there's – every organization in the United States, almost no matter what it is kind of suffering from a lack of volunteerism. I'm just going to encourage everybody, getting involved in these associations has been the greatest thing in my life. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you're around like people. And if you want to be successful in life, be careful what you listen to, what you watch on television or on your screens, on your small little smartphones. Be careful what you read and be careful, again, who you're hanging around with. And at these meetings, who you're hanging around with are people that are like-minded, people that have all the answers to the problems you might be having in practice. So early on, I started going to Central Ohio Chiropractic Association meetings, and I wasn't not involved in anything to that point, right? And all of a sudden, one of my friends raises his hand and says, I nominate Ron Faribault for treasurer. I went, what? That's what I learned. Never leave the room during the election. So next thing I know, I'm treasurer of the Central Ohio Chiropractic Association, and I just got involved. I worked my way through the chairs, became president of that organization, and then I went to my first Ohio State Chiropractic Association meeting, and I'll tell you, the speakers, and I don't mind naming a few, Rick McMichael, Stan Casebeer, Steve Blesser. Oh my God. I went to these conventions. I heard these guys speak. And I went, I want to be like those guys. Those guys are so articulate and so smart. And they had just such great information. So I got involved in the OSCA, worked my way through the chairs there, and became eventually president. And then along the way, when you become involved and you start to learn some things, how things work, and you know, it just winds up getting you involved. And it's been each level of involvement stretches you professionally and makes you be able to do things you wouldn't have been done, you would never been able to do otherwise. And just it kind of leads to this paper and CCGPP. You know, eventually, you know, I got appointed to serve on a state board. I got appointed to work on work comp in Ohio. So I've been appointed by two different governors. And it's only because of your willingness to be involved that kind of stuff happens. And then I got asked by the ACA to join CCGPP. And I'll never forget my good friend, I don't mind using his name either, Jeff Fedorko. He calls me when I was at a state association meeting and says, Ron, there's this new thing called CCGPP, and it's about guidelines, and we need you. I went, he says, he lied. He says, don't worry, there's not much work. So I said, sure,
yeah,
I'll do it.
Yeah, famous and last words.
I went to my first CCGPP meeting, and I met some wonderful people. I mean, Jay Triano and Al Adams, and so many of the leaders in our profession back then that were really knee deep into research, and it became a really cool experience. And each meeting I went to, it just got better and better and better. And I worked my way through the chairs there and became the chairman of that organization, and that led to people like Cheryl Hawk and others that literally pull you up and teach you about research and teach you about how clinical guidelines are made and things like that. Next thing you know, 15 published papers later, a book chapter and things like that. I mean, it's been a fun ride, but it's because I've met people along the way that have just been unbelievable. I mean, Lou Sportelli and Stephen Pearl changed my life when it came to research and getting more involved and understanding that we are in a war and research is our best weapon. That's simple. The question is, we've got this great research. Now, what do we do with it? And that's hopefully what we're going to talk about today somewhat.
So, for sure.
It's been a fun journey.
Yeah, for sure. Before we get into the paper, though, I'm curious, you've done all these amazing things. What is your daily life experience now? I know you're the director of this AMI organization. What do you, just tell us what you do.
That's a great question, Dr. Smith. The interesting thing is I have had a wonderful career in chiropractic, but I was a stubborn kind of traditionalist. I wanted to do manual manipulation, and I needed to feel that bone move and hear that bone move. And so I practiced Gonstead for 38 years. And the problem with that was it beat me up pretty good. And I've had some genetics in my family also, prone to arthritis. So after 38 years and 5 joint replacements, I physically could not keep going the way I was going, even though I loved it. And around that time, I got a call from the CEO of AMI, and it's not the Mike Carberry AMI, it's AMI Advanced Medicine Integration. You remember those two papers from 2004 and 2007 that shows when you go to a chiropractor, costs go down related to MRI, hospitalizations, ER use, things like that.
Yeah.
Well, that was AMI.
Okay.
That was the founder of our company was a guy named Dr. Richard Sarnott. He was a medical physician, and he partnered with a Wall Street guy named Jim Zechman, who formed AMI. They just had this idea that healthcare is broken. There's a better way to do this using conservative practitioners. So they started AMI, and after 5 joint replacements, they called and said, hey, we need a medical director. Would you be interested? I literally started laughing and looking at my broken body thinking, yeah, I'd be interested. So it's a way to, for me, it was a way to stay in chiropractic, but use my brain instead of my body. And I can help chiropractors from the inside now. Excuse me. So, and that's what I've done. And same thing when I got on the board of ODG, the board of advisors, it's a way to, you can't change things unless you're on the inside. And ODG is probably the best, you know, evidence-based guideline that exists. And, but they need help. They need expertise. And so we were able to show them several papers from CCGPP. As a result of that, they modified their own guideline to their credit and updated it. And, you know, that's how you help chiropractic, is from the inside. And with AMI, I love it. It's really an education company is what it is. We don't do traditional network management at AMI. We just do, we educate. That's what we do. We don't deny care, deny visits, deny costs. We don't do pre-auth. We don't charge people being in a network, anything like that. We literally just educate doctors on proper coding, documentation, and care management and guidelines. That's what we do. And that's how we save clients money. So it's been a really fun marriage between my experience at AMI and my experience with the Clinical Compass, and how research needs to be translated into clinical practice if it's going to be useful. And that's what I go around teaching, is how to take this research and how to apply it in your practice. That's what we do.
Well, that's a great segue to get into this paper then. And let me just give everybody the title of this, where it's published, so you can find it, and I'll leave a link on the podcast in the notes section as well, so everybody can access it. But the title of the paper is Cost of Chiropractic versus Medical Management of Adults with Spine-Related Musculoskeletal Pain, a Systematic Review. And this was published in Chiropractic and Manual Therapies. It's free, full text, so I encourage everybody to check it out. Again, I'll have the link there. But Dr. Farabaugh, let's just dive into this paper. I don't know where you'd want to start, but there's a lot to go through. So maybe just give us an overview of, maybe even first, like why did you come up with this? Why was this of interest? And then get us through the methods, et cetera.
That's a great question, too. The here's the reality. We know, we chiropractors know, that for our whole entire careers, almost all of us have improved patients' care. We basically grew as a profession on the backs of medical failures. And again, this is not a medical criticizing moment here. It's just the reality is we were kind of cast aside, and we don't need to get through the, you know, the anti-competitive things the AMA did in the past and the Wilkes lawsuit and all that fun stuff. But the reality is, many people turn to chiropractic last instead of first. But yet when you're a chiropractor, you know, if that patient just would have came to you first, you could have saved them a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of pain, a lot of unnecessary medical procedures, injections, drugs, and opioids, things like that. We know that. We also know since about 1991, there's been a mountain of literature that exist basically supporting what we all intuitively already know. So we said, you know what, let's do a cost effectiveness paper. And everybody was enthusiastically on board with that idea, because it's time to show the world what chiropractic can do, not just our own personal opinion, but what does the literature actually say? And this was a fun trip, because we started this process, and we found out the importance of a good librarian named Claire Knoll. Thank God for Claire, because she was able to find us papers that were just buried, and she was able to dig them up. But we started this whole process with, you know, 2,256 papers, 2,256 papers, and 93 which were full text articles, screened for eligibility. So we screened all these papers, and I'm not going to get into too deep in how the research sausage was made, but bottom line is our team, and we had a really dedicated team of involved members that took these 2,200 papers and basically called them down to 44 of the most important, highly rated papers that we could use. And so, and we created tables in the paper. There's, you're going to see five tables. The first one just includes the studies by design and by author. The second table includes studies from 2018 to 2022. And there was an interesting demarcation. There were a lot of papers that came out about that time, but dating clean back to 1991 to 2017, there were 27 papers. Now think about that. That's almost 40 years, right? And in the 27 papers that we found that were good quality papers, 1991 to 2017, that's table three. Well, in the 4 year period between 2018 and 2022, there were 17 other papers, good quality papers. And then table four is the summary findings of chiropractic management versus medical management by year of publication. And table five is the association of chiropractic care with factors affecting costs by study. So there's a mountain of information in these papers, but it dates clean back to 1991. And again, we knew there was a lot of information. We didn't realize when we started this just how much information there actually was. It's really amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, I really like the historical context you give, and just the fact that there are 17 papers just in the last few years speaks mountains, right? About just the amount of research that's being done here lately, and where the focus is seemingly going in healthcare in general. I mean, cost is a huge, huge factor. Who doesn't want to reduce cost, assuming that they still get good care? So, right. You know, well, why don't you tell us then, now that we've gone through a little bit of the methods, why don't you tell us what you found?
Well, what we found was, again, what we chiropractors kind of inherently knew. What we found was, if patients go to a chiropractor, costs in the system go way down. And they're costs related to, get used to the term downstream services and downstream costs. When you go to a chiropractor, you have less downstream services and their associated costs. And those services were related to things like advanced diagnostic imaging, less opioids, fewer surgeries, less hospitalizations. Less downstream costs overall, fewer injections, fewer specialist visits, including surgeon referrals, and fewer emergency room visits. Now, can you imagine a patient shows up to the emergency room? It's, you know, $3,000 just to walk through the front door, it seems. Well, if we can avoid that, if we can help people avoid, you know, what are the two biggest cost drivers? Emergency room and hospital stays. And according to all the studies dating back, when you accumulate the information, chiropractic lowers ER visits and hospital stays. So, I mean, it radically lowers opioid use. But, you know, opioids are cheap, right? I mean, if you eliminated totally opioids, it would barely move the needle of cost. But it's a great society benefit to get people off opioids. But in terms of cost, things your employers and insurance companies might be concerned about, it's really the offsetting of emergency room department, hospitals, surgeries, advanced imaging, injections, those high dollar procedures. So what we're doing is taking low cost, low tech chiropractic that's very, very effective. And we're finding if we go that route first, it offsets that high tech, high cost medical world. And again, there's a time and a place for medicine, and we need to collaborate a whole lot closer with medicine for the good of our patients. But the reality is, going to a chiropractor saves money, period. And the second thing we found in this paper that echoed what other papers have discovered is how early you go to a chiropractor matters. So if you think about this, if you're a patient with back pain, you come to a fork in the road. Okay, there's so many choices of how to handle back pain. So if you think about the two main choices, conservative care, medical care. So you have this fork in the road, right? And what we find is if we educate enough people, and that's why we want everybody accessing this paper, sharing it widely, so people get the idea. When you come to that fork in the road, when you have back pain, if you go to the conservative route, the chiropractic route, you're going to save massive amounts of money, and societal things like addiction to opioids and those kind of things. If you go to the medical route, costs escalate tremendously, not just a little, a lot. So if you're an employer, a union, anybody that's concerned about cost and the care of their employees, this is information you're going to want to know, right? So that's what we found. Going to a chiropractor works, but how early you go, it even works better if you go right out of the gate.
Right, right. And, you know, one of the things, there's so many things in this paper, honestly. Costs, that's the key concept. But I want to reiterate the concept of all of these factors that were associated with the last cost. You mentioned them. I'm just going to quick run through them again. So less use of advanced imaging like MRIs, CAT scans, that sort of thing. Less opioid use, fewer surgeries, less hospitalizations, fewer injections, fewer specialist visits, fewer emergency department visits. So, I mean, these are the outcomes when we look at the scientific literature. These are what people refer to as being guideline concordant. In other words, in agreement with clinical practice guidelines. So it seems to me, I'm still in practice part-time, but, you know, involved in research and teaching, that that this is what the guidelines are wanting. I mean, unless I'm missing something, this is exactly what the guidelines are sort of suggesting. And it looks like, based upon your study and other studies that are out there, that what the services that we are providing as chiropractors are having an impact on almost every single one of these suggested guideline outcomes. And so, I mean, you know, it should be, I think, what many people are striving for, what health in general should be striving for. And it just strikes me as it's almost too good to be true, to tell you the truth. Like, just looking at it, it's like, really?
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just curious, when you sat down with your other authors, were you thinking the same thing as me, or am I an outlier?
No, I think that everybody on this team, now, mind you, we went into it with a very blank slate. We were going to let the data tell the story, period. And wherever the data went, the data went. And I think we were even surprised, number one, on how much data there was. And then we were surprised at how strong the data was in supporting a conservative approach to back pain versus the standard medical approach. And then we're surprised even further by the data showing the earlier you go, the better it is. So you're right. Guideline concordant care is important. And what does that mean? I mean, the American College of Physicians, the NIH, the CDC, I mean, the American Pain Society, there's so many organizations out there that finally recognize manipulation, spinal manipulation, as the treatment of choice for acute back pain and chronic back pain. Then that wasn't that way not that long ago. They basically buried chiropractic. And there's still articles today that an uninformed author or a biased author will talk about the best treatments for back pain, and they won't even mention spinal manipulation and manual therapy. Now, keep in mind, we've got to keep in mind that chiropractic is a professional licensure, not a treatment. And too many people, you know, when they say chiropractic care, even though that terminology is in our paper, because everybody knows what that kind of means. Like, everybody knows dental care, you know what happens when you go to a dentist. You also know what happens when you go to a chiropractor, right? But too many people mistakenly equate the singular treatment of spinal manipulation to chiropractic as if that's the only thing we do. And chiropractic is far beyond that. And I think what the world needs to hear and come to grips with, and thankfully social media and stuff is accelerating this. Because when I first got involved in this, Dr. Smith, the statistic was it took 17 years for research to meet the marketplace. Well, that's thankfully, hopefully, that's not true anymore with social media and all the speed with which information is distributed now. We have this paper. We have this information. We have the data. And it is no longer acceptable for anybody to treat a patient with less effective care when there's so much information readily available at our fingertips, showing that these patients shouldn't be having opioids out the gate. They should be referred to a chiropractor, period. I mean, they should be. And whether it's the emergency room, whether a patient shows up to an orthopedic surgeon's office first or a primary care office first, we chiropractors need to have good functional relationships with these people, with these allied professionals, because every one of those patients should be referred first to a chiropractor before they even think about pharmacology, right? That's what all the data shows. It would be almost inexcusable now for somebody to get a script for an opioid without saying to that patient, you need to go to this chiropractor right away. So that's what we're hoping this paper does. It accelerates the information. And that's why, you know, we do this paper. We've got to get this paper out literally to everybody. But you can't send a paper to a medical colleague and say, look, we're better than you. We got to get a little bit better at messaging that, right? But most medical physicians I know want the patient to do really well, really fast. And if they feel comfortable for a chiropractor, they will readily and cooperatively refer to a chiropractor. And chiropractors also need to have those medical resources. So if you have a patient you're getting nowhere fast with, you better have lots of tools in your tool belt. And that also includes a referral to maybe a surgeon, maybe a physical therapist, maybe another colleague of yours, maybe to a person that does going to consider injections. And a lot of these chronic pain patients also need the services of behavioral health practitioners. You know, we have to have a biopsychosocial model for those chronic pain patients. The chiropractor shouldn't be acting in his own silo for those severe chronic patients. Mild, yeah, you could probably handle them on your own, right? We do that all the time as chiropractors. But if they're moderate to severe and they have numerous comorbidities, social determinants of health, numerous issues affecting their life, then a team approach, medical and chiropractic is important aspect of care, I believe. And that's what the guidelines basically suggest. There's a hierarchy, conservative first, and, you know, extreme medical procedures should be last, not first. So that's the direction we hope we're going to go here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I wanted to follow up on some of these favorable outcomes. Now, when I was reading through the paper, Table 5 really grabbed my attention. It's striking because it's all color-coded. I'll try to describe this, but Table 5 presents the types of costs and factors affecting costs that were found in all of these studies, and such type of costs included total costs, cost per episode, office visit costs, and the factors affecting those costs included things like diagnostic imaging, opioid surgery, hospitalization, and ER visits. And out of the 35 studies that were included in the table, there were 91 costs or factors that affected these costs that were reported. And I want to give listeners the sense of what they're going to see there when they look at it. They're going to see some boxes representing these factors where chiropractic is associated with either lower cost or lower utilization, and that those boxes are colored in green. Then there's cost or utilization didn't affect, wasn't any different between the groups, and that those were colored in yellow. And then some boxes were colored in red, and this was where chiropractic was associated with higher cost or higher utilization. I can tell you there were very few red boxes. But just a simple calculation that I did showed that there were 75 out of these 81 items that demonstrated lower cost or lower utilization through chiropractic care. In other words, lower total costs, lower surgeries, lower injections, lower diagnostic imaging. I mean, looking at that table, it's almost all green. It's 92.6% green. And right. That was just, I mean, you know, it was striking. I'll just say it that way. And I know you said your team was a bit surprised at how impressive it was. And, you know, I do want to mention that there was, out of all the studies, I believe there was only one randomized trial, which has the highest evidence for determining causation. But nonetheless, it's very impressive if all the data, the highest quality data that's out there suggests all of this green, or, you know, 92.6% showing these really positive effects of chiropractic care. That is impressive.
Yeah. The interesting thing about Chart 5, it's a really graphic visual representation of what we've been talking about. And, you know, when you start to look at this issue and what research is available, there weren't that many randomized controlled trials, right? We identified one that was really good to put in the study, met our inclusion and exclusion criteria. But most of these studies were cohort studies and or economic evaluations. And, you know, when you think of the word cohort, just think of group, you know, take a group of people. And most of these studies are done off you know, real live databases of payers, including the VA, military, and a lot of other payers, Medicare. And what it basically showed is, not too surprising, some studies show that the cost to go to a chiropractor is higher per visit, and sometimes it takes more visits. So our critics would argue, see, you got to go to a chiropractor more often and the cost is higher. Well, wait a minute. Remember, chiropractic doesn't exist in its own little silo. And that's the problem with medicine. In medicine, everybody's in their own little silo of knowledge. And frankly, the silos don't touch. And that's how so many people wind up with 18, 19 medications, you know, later in life, because people aren't talking to each other. But you can't look at it as a silo. Yeah, somebody might, per visit, it might cost more per visit, because if I go to my PCP and the only thing he's going to do is give me a prescription, well, okay, that's one visit, one time. But how effective is that? And the answer is not very, right? So it might go to a chiropractor, it might cost more, and it might take more visits compared to going to your MD that you might see once a month. However, when you look at the total costs, and that's what employers are concerned about, you know, anybody that's taking risks, financial risk, understands you can't look at the silos of a single visit to a chiropractor versus a single visit to an MD. You got to look at single visit to a chiropractor and the episode, the entire episode and continuum of care, and how that affects other downstream services and costs. And that's what we really want to look at. If you go to a chiropractor, what happens not just to the chiropractic spend, but what happens to cost in the overall total system? And that's where these other issues came in, where you're talking about advanced imaging, opioid surgeries, hospitalizations, ER use, that kind of thing. When you go to a chiropractor, yeah, it might cost, you know, more per visit than going to one visit to an MD, but the downstream costs are dramatic if you don't start out this healthcare journey of back pain by going to a conservative care practitioner. And that's essentially what this chart shows. Is there's a lot of green, and because chiropractic is associated with either lower cost or lower utilization, and that's the name of the game. If we can get better outcomes with less costs, I mean, keep in mind, right now most of us are serving in a fee for service world, right? That is going to be replaced, if you have been reading, with value based healthcare, right? What does that mean? Excuse me. That basically means you've got to get good outcomes at a lower cost. I'll contrast two different chiropractors without mentioning names, of course. And, you know, one chiropractor, he might boast he gets really, really great results in just two or three visits going to him with his special technique, but he might charge $200, $300 a visit. So those two or three visits might cost $1,000, right? And another chiropractor, it might take six or eight visits for that same condition, but at half that cost. So if you're the employer and you're the one paying the bills, or you're the health insurance company, the payer, and you're paying the bills, which of those two doctors are more attractive to you? The one who got an outcome for half price, or the one who got an outcome for twice the price? So in a value-based world, we've got to be cognizant of what we are causing the system. And that's a very, very important concept to grasp, because in a value-based system, he who gets the best results for the lowest cost wins. And that's what is coming in the future. And the doctors have become very used to fee-for-service, and I understand it. I've functioned my whole career in fee-for-service. It's just the system we live in. But you're going to have to compete. You're going to have to get better results and lower cost. And I'll never forget, just a little side story. You know, I developed this thing called the medical referral system. It was basically how to communicate with MDs, how to educate MDs about chiropractic. And it was really well received. And I saw one of the doctors, I mean, this is after I left practice, mind you, this happened just within the last year. I saw one of the PCPs in the gym. Now, mind you, this guy's referred to me for years. I referred to him for years. We've never met. He just knew me because I sent him research every single month. So my name was in front of him all the time. I sent him research every month. I sent him initial reports, updated reports, and discharge summaries on all the patients that came in that were his patients. I do that with all my medical professionals. And I asked him, I said, hey, doc, first off, I said, wait, you're Dr. So-and-so? Oh, my God, I've never met you. I'm so glad to finally meet you, right? And he's, oh, Ron, oh, my God, yes, I've been referring to you for years. So we got to talk, and I said, you know, all the research I sent you over the years? He said, yeah. I said, did you like it? I mean, was it beneficial to you? He said, oh, yeah, that research was great. That's why I sent so many patients to you. He said, but you missed the mark on one thing. I went, oh, really? Tell me about that. What is that? He says, you guys never talk about business and cost. I says, well, what do you mean? He belongs to the largest group of MDs in this area, right? There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and they belong to the same organization. And they're so big, they take risk. In other words, they might get a book of business from Medicare, and Medicare gives them X amount of dollars. So, and they have to treat these patients with that amount of money. And he said, so think about this, Ron. He says, we know what all the surgeons charge. We know what all the physical therapists charge. We know what all the specialists charge. And if there's two surgeons out there, one takes care of a back pain for $10,000 and the other one takes care of one consistently for $4,000, who do you think you're going to refer to when we're taking the risk? Went, holy geez, I didn't think of that. And he said, yeah, same thing with you chiropractors. I mean, you guys are great. But why does it take 6 visits to one chiropractor and 36 visits to another? And who do you think we're going to refer to? I thought that was the most enlightening message I have heard for a long time. We chiropractors have to get more efficient, and we have to educate the medical profession on what we do and why we make a good choice for them, right? And it's all about taking risk, financial risk, and that's just an important thing that most chiropractors don't consider. Frankly, I didn't consider it when I was writing the medical referral system articles. So this has just been an interesting journey of enlightenment, really, of how healthcare actually works.
Yeah, no doubt. And that isn't really interesting what that medical doctor mentioned to you. I'd also like to follow that up and just say from your study that there were no studies that found that chiropractic care had higher overall costs. I think that's an important point to mention, right, especially when looking at that table with all the green again. And another question, and you might have answered this in a way, but I want to just directly ask you. In the paper, you found that there were a couple of articles mentioned that chiropractic office visits were a little higher. And that was only when referral costs were not included in the calculation. So I think I have an idea what went into the referral costs, but I didn't read the paper. So what exactly did that involve?
Well, in every paper, there are, you know, if you're going to reduce the risk of bias, you have to acknowledge things that are limiting factors in your research. And the reality is, in some of these papers that showed a higher overall cost, they had to acknowledge that those papers didn't include the cost of physical therapy, didn't include the cost of opioids, didn't include the cost of referrals. And so anybody that would actually read that and understand what that means is, okay, so the paper might have showed increased costs, but if you didn't consider any of the downstream costs, then it really didn't cost as much as you think. In fact, if you look at all the other papers in aggregate, conservative approach, because of the offsetting of downstream services the costs are dramatically lower in paper after paper. So it gets to the point that we chiropractors, we got to get really, really good at reading a paper, the whole paper. Too many of us, and I was guilty of this for a long time myself, too many of us read the highlights, read the title, and we don't get past the title because the title's so cool. Or we might read the abstract, and we don't even read the abstract. We just jump right to the conclusion of the abstract and without actually reading the whole paper. So some of these papers, especially some of the ones coming out of a certain individual in Europe, are very, very critical about chiropractic. But when you dive down into the paper and find out, like I never ever read the methodology before in papers until probably 20 years ago, right? And the methodology is important, you know, to find out how they actually structured the study. And then you got to read those exclusion and inclusion and exclusion criteria. You have to read about the limitations to find out how applicable this paper is. And then the most interesting thing I found is sometimes the conclusion in a paper doesn't even match what the body of the paper actually was suggesting. So you got to be just so careful and read these things critically. And that's what we chiropractors got to get really good at, is a critical evaluation of these papers. So our team had very strict criteria we had to follow to rate. Every single paper was rated by three different reviewers. Three different people did the data extraction. Three different people did the actual rating of the papers. Typically, there were two, but if there's any disagreement, the third was involved. So we followed a very stringent process to make sure the data in this paper was accurate.
I'm really glad you mentioned about the abstract and the body of the paper. Especially in the last few years, there's been a disconnect, we'll say, between right. The abstract and what you find in the actual paper. So I'm really glad that you mentioned for chiropractors and others to dive into the paper, really spend some time. It makes a big difference. You really glean the meat and potatoes out of the paper, so to speak, by diving in like that. We've talked throughout this conversation a little bit about, you know, how maybe to disseminate some of this information, like you're talking with your medical doctor colleague and sending research and things like that. But I want to just spend a little bit of time now. You've got this paper, all sorts of interesting things that were found. What can chiropractors do, or maybe not even chiropractors, but others that are interested? How do we disseminate this? Because that's an important part of research. It should be in my mind, a public enterprise. I mean, this is for the betterment of society.
Right. Well, this is a really important question, because we in chiropractic, we have had great papers throughout our history. We really have. Where our primary weakness is in dissemination of this information. So if we have, we have this great ammo, the question is, where are we going to point our gun to fire the ammo, right? Where are we going to spread this information, and how are we going to spread this information? And just a little pitch to the Clinical Compass. I hope everybody goes to theclinicalcompass.org and becomes a member of the Clinical Compass, because remember, everybody in the Clinical Compass basically are volunteers. Nobody's getting paid. And we're constantly in a funding battle. Because it costs money to publish this paper. It costs money we had to pay the journal, for example, to make this open access. So chiropractors individually didn't have to pay for this paper, but that cost money from our organization to do that. And so I wish everybody would go to clinicalcompass.org and consider joining. And we have an evidence center associated with the Clinical Compass. It's outstanding. You got an issue with anything, there's evidence in there. Regarding many, many, many different topics. So we got to get better at dissemination. So what should you do with this paper? First, go to Chiropractic and Manual Therapies and search for this paper and download it from the journal itself. Resist the temptation just sending the paper around to each other. Go to the journal and click on the link on the journal to download the paper. That's number one. It's the easiest way for anybody to get the paper. So there's a little button there that says cite this paper. or clicked us. I can't remember actually what it says. I think it says cite this paper. And if you just click on that link, you'll go right to the paper. You can copy that link and send it to your colleagues, to your patients. So how do you do this? Basically, who needs this paper? I'm going to suggest everybody needs this paper. This paper should be in the hands of every patient you have, with maybe a little summary that you write on, you know, here's what the paper says. If you go to a chiropractor, costs go down, blah, blah, blah. And it needs to go to every union, every employer in the country, every insurance company. Now, keep in mind, the temptation is to just send this to insurance companies. But the reality is maybe half of the book of business of insurance is they're taking risk. The other half, they're just servicing, say, a big self-insured policy or benefits. So they're not taking risks, so it's not as important to them. However, every insurance company should have this in their pocket to understand ways they can save money for their clients. Every employer should have this paper. So if you've got contacts in your patient population that work for employers, work for insurance companies, this paper should be in the hands of every legislator in the country. Right now, as you well know, we're fighting this battle in Washington, the Medicare Modernization Act, right? To get chiropractors paid properly, equally, open scope, full service, what we do. And based on these papers and a whole lot more papers just like this, there's no reason to put limits on chiropractic. In fact, putting limits on chiropractic is costing them money. They just don't realize it because they're so used to looking at chiropractic in a silo. They're used to looking at the word chiropractic as a line item on a budget. And they just go, wait, chiropractic costs us X amount of dollars. Oh, we need to reduce that, or we can't raise that. What we need to educate them on is that, oh no, chiropractic's one line item on this budget. But when you go to a chiropractor, you're saving 10 other line items on this budget and lowering the amount of overall spend. So we just need to educate everybody. We need an army of doctors willing to get involved with the state associations. So I'm going to suggest this is really a call to action. We need everybody as possible to join CCGPP so we have the funding available so we can continue this journey of research and dissemination. We need everybody listening to join their state associations. If you don't belong to your state association, please consider joining today. Because remember, the strength of chiropractic in this country and around the world is in direct proportion to the strength of our state associations. And the state associations are only as strong as their membership, right? So join the state association, get involved, and start to distribute. You're going to see from the Clinical Compass different promotional pieces coming out about this and other papers. Please distribute those information, those bullets, those newsreels, things like that. Distribute those to everybody that you know. And that's how we're going to get the word out of chiropractic. And thankfully, in the world of social media, again, it doesn't take 17 years for this research to reach the marketplace. It takes about 27 seconds, right? I mean, it's amazing what social media can do. And we need to take advantage of that to get this information out there.
No doubt. You know, the thing that still strikes me about this paper, and you mentioned it just a minute ago, were again, all the downstream effects, the line items. I like that's a beautiful way to describe it. It's not just chiropractic care, but the savings on all, you know, limited or less use of all these other services that are very costly and frankly, probably don't add health to people.
That's right.
I think that's a really important point.
One of the things we learned in the company I work for at AMI, you know, we have a chronic pain program, for example. Our real life data, this isn't theory, our real life data shows that when you take these severe chronic pain patients that typically did not have access to chiropractic, because most, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, they don't cover chronic, right? They only cover acute. But in our program, we've got waivers to allow patients to go to a chiropractor, physical, or a chiropractor, massage therapist, acupuncturist in our program. Our data shows you go to a chiropractor, for example, just twice a month to help control their chronic pain, opioid use goes down around 87% in just 12 months. Emergency room visits go down 70%+. Hospital days go down 70%+. We save state Medicaid around the country millions and millions of dollars by getting patients into low-tech, low-cost chiropractic, massage, acupuncture versus high-cost, high-tech medical. Now, I'm not saying some of these patients don't need medical. They certainly do. But we chiropractors have been underutilized, especially in the chronic care space. And if anybody's ever interested in expanding Medicaid in your states, boy, contact me after this, because we've got some really good opportunities because of the cost savings of chiropractic.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Dr. Farabaugh, we're getting to a close here soon, but you know, one of the goals of the podcast has been, and will probably always be, to try to encourage more people to get into research. And every one of us have had a different journey along the way, and yours is I think, actually, like many, not exactly the same, but, you know, been in practice and you want to help, and this is just one of the ways to help. I'm curious what advice you could offer aspiring chiropractors or students who want to get involved in research. What advice might you give to them?
Yeah, that's really a good question, because I'm a typical chiropractor. I had no research background whatsoever when I started this journey. And, you know, if you want to accomplish something really big in life, surround yourself with people much smarter than you, right? I mean, the number one message would be, don't be afraid of it. I mean, get involved in Clinical Compass if possible, get involved in your college, get involved in your research clubs. And what'll happen little by little by little, you learn how the research sausage is made. It was so imposing to me. The guys that do top-notch research in this country, I mean, those guys are just total brainiacs. And I thought, man, I cannot compete. I mean, these guys are so far beyond me in terms of their knowledge of research. But what happens is these guys are also the biggest givers on the planet, and they want to pull you along. They pull you up. They get you on a committee. Next thing you know, you're involved in a paper as just one of the team members. You're not in charge of the whole thing. You find out how it's done, and then all of a sudden you get involved in another one, and then another one, and then another one. And next thing you know, you're all these papers down the road with your name on them. And it's just a fun journey. And the reality is, doing the literature, doing the research is really fun, learning how the difference between these different variety of papers. You know, what's a cohort paper? What's an economic evaluation? What's a systematic review? What's a randomized controlled trial? What's a clinical practice guideline? Can I actually help make one of those things? And don't be afraid. Just get involved. And the people that are really good at this, like yourself, Dr. Smith, I mean, how many people have you taught and have you mentored towards their research journey? And that's what the top researchers are so willing to do. They're nothing but a big bunch of givers. And so don't hesitate to get involved. And a good place to start is your college as a student. And when you get out, get involved with your state association and get involved with the Clinical Compass. First is just a member. And then if you feel so inclined, if you feel comfortable, start coming to some meetings. We don't have a lot of meetings, actually. We have, you know, one major meeting a year. But each state should have some research committee or something, so they're aware of what's coming out. And again, just get involved. That's the number one thing.
Yeah, great advice. I'm really thrilled to be becoming involved in the Clinical Compass as well. So I look forward to working with you on some projects in the future there. And for sure, definitely become a member, help out with, like you said, I mean, all of these things require money, right? To publish the papers, article processing charges, they're called, right? APCs. And so, I mean, those are several thousand dollars for most journals for a single paper. So, you know, They're not a super low amount of money. They're not necessarily super prohibitive either, but you add it up. If you've got multiple papers a year, it certainly adds up. And I think chiropractors right. are not aware of all the costs that go in. And if you're like myself and you, I know, and many others who do this because we love the profession, I mean, I use oftentimes my own money to pay for these things, right? I mean, it's not coming out of my business, my personal money, because I feel like it's important to do this stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, I appreciate everything you do. Really appreciate this paper and everybody else that was involved in it. I appreciate what Clinical Compass is doing. And it's been a real pleasure to have you on. I think chiropractors everywhere are going to learn a lot from this. And I just, again, appreciate everything that you do.
Thank you so much. Just one parting thought for me is just imagine a future where if we get this information out there and we help payers and unions and employers and self-insureds understand this issue, just imagine a world where there's reduced barriers to access chiropractic providers. There's lower copays, lower deductibles, no pre-authorization. Imagine a world where patients can get to a chiropractor much, much easier, faster, right out of the gate, and that chiropractors are compensated fairly for that work because of how much we're going to reduce downstream services and associated costs. That's why we need to get out and educate everybody, all the legislators, everybody, because that world's not going to happen until we take this paper out there and start educating everybody about this topic. So get out there and just do it.
Very good. Very good. Well, let that be the last word. Dr. Farabaugh, thanks so much again for coming on the Chiropractic Science Podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me, Dr. Smith.
Absolutely.